see Montgomery Burns. Simpson, Simpson.
This State of the Union is outrageous. Smithers, see to it that the president is removed from office.
Smithers!
Smithers, why haven't I heard of this leader? He's as rich and wicked as I, but he seems to be enjoying tax-exempt status.
Excellent.
I've been waiting 25 years for this moment.
Excellent, Smithers. Excellent.
Well, one of those amateur YouTube Mr. Burns may be drafted to go pro. Harry Shearer, the voice of Mr. Burns and Ned Flanders, is leaving The Simpsons after 27 seasons. We'll have more on that coming up. First, former Los Angeles Undersheriff Paul Tanaka turned himself in to authorities this morning. The FBI and the Justice Department charged Tanaka with obstruction of justice, that he repeatedly sabotaged an investigation by the feds into civil rights violations at the Men's Central Jail. Acting U.S. Attorney for Los Angeles, Stephanie Yonakura, said that Tanaka's alleged actions were part of a pattern.
Nearly 10 years ago, Tanaka was told about problem deputies at the Men's Central Jail. And in spite of this knowledge, Tanaka later told deputies that they should be acting in the gray area of the law, and that he believed that the Internal Affairs Bureau should be taken from 45 investigators to just one.
And the former head of internal criminal investigations at the Sheriff's Department was also charged today. Celeste Freeman is founder and editor of Witness LA, and that reports on criminal justice issues, and she was there today. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's start with the background here. The indictment stems from this case back in 2011, where the Sheriff's Department found out that a prisoner in its jail was an FBI informant. And what happened after that?
Well, it began when they recovered a contraband phone from this inmate named Anthony Brown, but then they found that the main numbers the guy was calling all went to the FBI office in Westwood. So Sheriff Baca and then Undersheriff Paul Tanaka knew early on that this was part of an FBI undercover investigation. But what happened shortly thereafter, according to these allegations, is that former Undersheriff Paul Tanaka and his co-conspirators, seven of whom have already been convicted, former members of the Sheriff's Department, engaged in this elaborate plan to hide Anthony Brown, the FBI informant, from his federal handlers, and that, in general, did all they could to obstruct the FBI's investigation into wrongdoing, corruption, and brutality in the jails. And as you mentioned, Madeline, one of the interesting things about this particular set of indictments is that the indictment talks about all these introductory allegations of the former undersheriff actively getting in the way of investigations by the Sheriff's Department into this pattern of abuse and corruption going on inside the jail.
So Paul Tanaka is accused in this indictment of obstruction of justice. Does that mean the charges are solely about moving Anthony Brown around and trying to hide him from the FBI, or are there other charges as well?
Well, there are also some correlative acts of obstruction that he's charged with. There were two sergeants that confronted an FBI agent outside her home and threatened her with arrest falsely. The two sergeants have already been convicted of obstruction. So there was that. There's the allegation that Mr. Tanaka and also Mr. Carey were part of actions like talking to possible deputies who could be possible witnesses to this investigation into brutality in the jails and telling them not to cooperate with the FBI.
Hmm. Tom Carey is the former head of Internal Affairs.
He's the former head of ICIB, which is like Internal Affairs except the criminal side.
I see.
Internal Affairs investigates wrongdoing. ICIB investigates criminal wrongdoing inside the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. And he was the head of ICIB at the time.
So the irony here being he is the guy in charge of investigating corruption inside the Sheriff's Department, allegedly trying to cover up an investigation into corruption.
Well, and the other thing that the indictment outlines is how Mr. Tanaka and Mr. Carey, and in particular Mr. Tanaka, were warned over and over again that there was wrongdoing going on inside the jail and that Mr. Tanaka actually tried to get in the way of the wrongdoing being investigated by the department, and that he did things like told deputies to, quote, work in the gray. And they used that terminology, which we have documents going back 10 years of Tanaka allegedly meeting with groups of deputies and telling them to work the gray and work it hard. Now, he has said that really what he meant is, you know, you really want to, you know, really work hard, but within the law. But those who were present at those meetings say otherwise.
So does the indictment say that Paul Tanaka directed all this, that he was the brains behind this?
It implies that. It's going to be interesting because what about that other guy, the former sheriff, Lee Baca? He was present in a lot of these meetings. So one of the big questions we all have now is the fact that they're now indicted Paul Tanaka. Does that mean that they're going after Lee Baca?
So the investigation is still ongoing. Perhaps charges could come for former sheriff Lee Baca. Meanwhile, Paul Tanaka is saying these allegations are baseless and he's going to fight them vigorously?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. He's been, you know, he testified in these previous trials in which the seven members of the sheriff's department have already been convicted of obstruction of justice. And I should say that their cases are being appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit has agreed to take the appeal, so their appeals are being heard probably in September. So although they've been convicted, nobody has gone to prison because the Ninth Circuit, you know, wants to take a look at it. But Tanaka testified at those trials for the defense, and he said, oh, you know, I really didn't know it, the details of what was going on, and we were just trying to keep Anthony Brown safe. We were never trying to keep him from other members of law enforcement, and we certainly weren't trying to, we had no intention of keeping him from the FBI. But, you know, I mean, we'll see if the federal government can prove that, in fact, there was this other intent. Having looked at some of the underlying emails that they have, there's certainly a lot that suggests it. Whether it rises to beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, will be up to a jury. But there's a lot of interesting stuff that the acting U.S. attorney said we have a lot of emails, that they believe will prove their case.
Celeste Freeman, founder and editor of Witness LA. Thanks, Celeste.
Thanks, Madeline.
This is the tale of a Pandora's box, unleashed with the discovery of the largest emerald in the world.
At a staggering 840 pounds, the Brazilian Bahia emerald is thought to be the biggest uncut emerald in the world, and it lives in an evidence locker at an undisclosed Sheriff's Department facility here in Los Angeles. Today, the Brazilian government and an Idaho businessman are in court arguing over who owns that emerald. And before the Bahia emerald ended up in L.A., it went on a globe-spanning adventure over the course of 8 years. To explain this journey is Brandon Burrell from Bloomberg News. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's go back in time to 2001. It was first discovered in Brazil. Who found it, and how did it end up here?
Sure. Well, the stone was pulled out of the ground in northeastern Brazil in the state of Bahia. This is a region where there's a lot of artisanal prospectors who are hunting for emeralds. And many of these emeralds are kind of low quality. They're used for costume jewelry and to decorate buildings. But there's also some enormous ones down there in this ground. And apparently a old prospector who had a mine there pulled this enormous thing out around the summer of 2001. And it changed hands a few times, going up in value with each sale.
How much is it worth?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the easy answer is it's worth as much as anyone's willing to pay.
Uh-huh.
When right at the mine site, the first person who bought it paid just $5,000 for it. Since then, we've seen some pretty wacky appraisals out there. A gemologist in São Paulo estimated its value at $972 million. He later lowered it to about $400 million. And I haven't seen any other figures besides that. So you could say, hey, it's somewhere between $5,000 and $400 million.
Wow. And it's just enormous. What does it look like at 840 pounds?
I mean, it looks like an asteroid. I mean, this thing is... It doesn't look like your classic emerald, right? This is a geological specimen. So it's got a bunch of black, chunky rock at the base. This is what's called schist. And then there's these columns coming out. And these are, you know, it looks like sticks of kryptonite coming out of this thing. Some people have seen it, said, hey, it's kind of ugly. But, you know, it is a pretty spectacular scientific object, I think.
Okay, so it makes its way over here. It ends up in the Silicon Valley, of course. Some entrepreneur gets his hands on it. And then it somehow ends up in New Orleans, submerged during the floods of Hurricane Katrina.
That is the legend, yes.
How did that happen?
Let me take you back to Silicon Valley,
okay.
Actually. So basically, in the beginning, there were a couple businessmen in Brazil had a partnership with some folks out in California, and they had this idea that they could bring the emerald to the U.S. and use it to raise money for their Silicon Valley startup. That didn't really work out too well, and so then they started playing around with other business ideas. And at one point, one of the members of the team said, you know, we need to send this out to New Orleans. I think this is going to be a place where we can make a sale and get all our money back. And there was a little bit of a dispute between some of the members on the team. And right at that moment is when Hurricane Katrina hit. And I've heard, oh, the emerald was submerged in 6 feet of water. But I've also heard, hey, maybe there was just a trickle at the base. I don't really know what the full story is. Suffice it to say, the emerald made its way back to California and became involved in a number of other interesting and elaborate money-making schemes.
Hmm. So now, who is fighting the Brazilian government for it?
Right. So over the course of this last 8 years, we had the emerald was being used in all these different business ventures, and a number of investors would come in. They thought, oh, this is a good idea. I'm going to make some money off this emerald. And then when things didn't exactly work out, they ended up sort of suing each other. And so we've had this 8-year actually, it's a 6-year battle where each of these investors has sort of said, I get a piece of the emerald. And they've kind of been, their claims have been knocked away. The only person who's left is Kit Morrison, and he's a guy from Idaho. He's a businessman who's had various real estate ventures and so on. And he says that he got ownership of the emerald when a separate diamond deal fell through. And he is, you know, currently basically the only man left standing.
Mm-hmm.
And just when he thought he was going to be able to snatch it away, late last year, the Brazilian government stepped in and said, hey, wait a second, that emerald was illegally exported from our country, and it's a national treasure, and we want it back.
And so that's what they're fighting over today.
That's what they're fighting over today. I'm not sure the specifics of this current trial and whether it's going to resolve the issue. Seems like every time we think there's going to be closure in the case, we have another twist or turn.
Yeah, well, it does sound like something out of a movie. And also, what raises the question, it's 840 pounds. How does this thing just keep moving around so quickly and adeptly from various locations?
I think you need a forklift or a bunch of very strong men and women to lift this thing up. It's been placed in a wooden crate. I've seen photos of the crate with some foam padding and so on. I don't think it's an easy thing to move around and also to protect. It's been in a number of different vaults.
Yeah. So did it reveal to you the kind of maybe seamy, but definitely underreported underground world of gem trading?
Absolutely. I had no idea how this business worked. And I actually still don't really think I know. I think anybody who sees a gemstone, you get hypnotized by it. It is spectacular that this type of object can be created from the pressure inside the earth. And then you have the question of, well, how much is something like this actually worth? And with the Bahia Emerald, it's really just worth as much as people are willing to pay. Is this, you know, this is a one-of-a-kind object. It's not like a commodity like gold or that's regularly traded where we actually have a good idea about the price. And so there's a lot of room for people to sort of pump up the price. And part of what pumps up the price is the story. And the Bahia Emerald has this spectacular, elaborate story. So, I do think it's going to be worth quite a bit of money, and it's going to be worth quite a bit to somebody. I just don't know how much that's going to be.
Brendan Burrell, reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on the program, LA's minimum wage is likely to go up to $15 an hour in 5 years. We'll hear more about that next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles is one step closer today to raising the city's minimum wage from $9 to $15 an hour. Yesterday, a city council committee approved the increase. The full city council is expected to vote on it next week. If the measure passes, LA's restaurants are likely to feel some of the biggest impacts, and owners in the industry are asking city officials to reconsider the proposal. They want tips to be counted toward the minimum wage for waiters, waitresses, and bartenders. Joining me now, George Aboudaoud. He owns Bowery Street Enterprises, a group of 9 restaurants in Los Angeles. That includes Bowery, Delancey, and Rosewood Tavern. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Also on the line, Elizabeth Brennan. She's a spokeswoman for the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
George, let's start with you. If this goes through as is, how would it affect your business?
I think in general, for the restaurant business, it's going to be detrimental. I have to say that we, as the independent restaurants of Los Angeles, came forward in support of an increase in the minimum wage. We want the city council to do it in a wise fashion. So what we presented was using the total compensation model, something that's done in most of the markets in the country, where the tips that we're talking about that are taxed by the employer. So, for example, all tips that are recorded and reported, employers pay payroll taxes on them. They also administer those tips. They are required to report them to the IRS, and they go on the paychecks. So what we were saying, in an effort to help mitigate losses for independent restaurants and as well for all kinds of jobs within our industry, that we want to support an increase for all the non-tipped employees who are not getting the prevailing wage that the city wants, so we all land on common ground. So we presented a common solution that would work for everyone, and I'm not sure that the Economic Development Committee heard us. I'm not sure if they actually understand the entire situation.
So you would include tips in the minimum wage?
Correct. And if, for example, if the tips did not reach what the prevailing minimum wage is, the employer would be required to make up that difference.
And Elizabeth, what's wrong with that proposal?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's something that obviously is being debated in the city council and has come up a lot because various restaurant owners have been talking about this. I think what is missing from that description of the total compensation, or as we would call it, a sub-minimum wage model, is that the vast majority of workers in tipped industries, so that includes restaurant, nail salons, massage therapists, car wash, things like that, the vast majority of those workers make less than $25,000 a year. And so the majority of tipped workers in LA don't work in restaurants either.
So could you just carve out an exception for restaurants?
I mean, I think the situation in California is that we don't have a tipped minimum wage like in other states, and there's good reason for that, because the minimum wage is the only piece of compensation that's guaranteed. And I think you see with the average wages that these industries that where workers rely on tips are still by and large very low wage, and people are living in poverty. And what we're looking for here in the city of LA and this robust debate that's been really good is how do we lift people out of poverty, and how do we make sure that people who are working full time are not living in poverty? And LA is one of the wealthiest cities in the nation, but then we have hundreds of thousands of people who are struggling to get by just on very low salaries.
And George, what about that? Maybe the waiters and waitresses in your restaurants earn healthy tips, but there are plenty of restaurants where waiters and waitresses do not get a lot in tips.
Yeah, let me clarify that. Elizabeth, we're talking here about recorded and reported tips. If you're talking about car wash, when somebody's handing over dollars, it's not reported, recorded. That's not what we're discussing. We're not talking about the dollars in the tip jar. We're talking about recorded and reported tips. So you have to be very clear. It's the tips that go onto a paycheck that are taxed, that the employee is taxed and the employer is taxed. So let's be 100% clear about that so we don't go backwards on the conversation. Also, something else that Elizabeth brought up and Rusty Hicks also from AFL-CIO is this conversation about what they're bringing home as an annual salary. The conversation we're having is hourly wage, and the conversation switching it to what somebody's making annually doesn't help our conversation. In the restaurant industry, a lot of people aren't here as a salary, it's hourly wage. That's the whole discussion that we're having. And they keep bringing in other portions of the conversation, which cloud the entire conversation. And now we understand the income gap and the income disparity. That's a big issue in Los Angeles. And Elizabeth is right. There's a lot of wealthy people and a lot of very low-income people. But that gap is not between the small business owners and their employees. That gap is between a lot of other different people. So it seems disingenuous to put the onus on the small business owners of Los Angeles, whether they be restaurants or others, to make up for all the faults of the city, from the housing crisis, from the lack of education, from whatever is happening here in Los Angeles, to put the onus only on the small businesses. That's really the difficult part to swallow here.
Elizabeth, I want you to answer that, but also this idea that in other states, New York, for example, they do this idea, this total compensation model where they count the tips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they have tipped credit in New York. Here, you know, is Jerry Brown actually in his first administration who signed the law into effect in California outlawing a sub-minimum wage in our state. I think that it's important that we not carve out large sections of workers and leave them behind in this conversation when we're talking about how to raise wages and how to help people, working families in Los Angeles, and that carving out one industry will both leave them behind and also create a model that isn't what we're, I think, what the intent of this conversation and debate is in Los Angeles. And I think, you know, that point was reiterated also by the editorial pages in the Los Angeles Times, that this is a dangerous road to go down, and to ensure that wages are equitable, you know, there are other methods to do that, but lowering the minimum wage for one category of workers, especially when it represents so many, is not the right solution.
George, what's going to happen to your business if this goes through? Will you just raise the prices of the food you serve?
Well, I need to clarify one thing, because we're going backwards on the conversation. We're not talking about a sub-minimum wage. That term is so disingenuous. What we're saying is that these tips are already on the paycheck. I, as an employer, or all other employers, we pay payroll taxes on these tips. We are responsible to administer these tips. We even pay the credit card fees on these tips. So we're not talking about something in a bubble. We're talking about something that is literally on the paycheck. So if the federal government can treat it as a wage, we're not sure why the city can't treat it as a wage. And that's part of the difficulty of this conversation, is always throwing in these clouds and these smoke and mirrors to try to cover up the real conversation.
But I guess that's if they're declared, right? I mean, if it's all cash, sometimes they're not declared.
Well, right, and that's up to the employee. You know, if they're not declaring cash, that works in their favor. I mean, it's not really on the it doesn't help the employer, of course. But what we're trying to do is come up with a viable solution. So what we're saying is the margins in this business, the restaurant business margins, are already very, very tight. We are more concerned about our employees and our sustainability than the AFL-CIO. We're not looking for new membership. We're not looking for new monies from anyone. We just want to preserve our jobs and our businesses. So in terms of what we're doing, we said, you know what, let's come out and support a wage increase. Let's do that because we want to support higher wages for people in Los Angeles. Now, we have employees. You know, if you're a tipped employee, you're generally making above the minimum wage, and in many cases, well above the minimum wage. And if you're not, the employer will have to make up the difference.
What do you think the minimum wage should be? What would you like it to be?
Well, the minimum wage currently is 9. It's going to 10. I can tell you that I don't have any non-tipped employees that are at the minimum. So, I mean, we're...
But you said you support an increase. What would that be?
I mean, I would say increase that is measured across time. Mayor Garcetti came out with a $13.25. I think he won it 3 years. I think if that went on for about over the course of 5 years, that could help a lot of small businesses and restaurants kind of slowly edge up and get there.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. George Abu Daoud owns Bowery Street Enterprises, a group of 9 restaurants here in L.A., and Elizabeth Brennan, spokeswoman for the L.A. County Federation of Labor. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we would love to know what you think. Should restaurants be able to include tips in the minimum wage? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the documentary Iris tells the story of 93-year-old fashion icon Iris Apfel. It was Albert Maisel's last movie. He and his brother David redefined documentary filmmaking. We'll talk about their legacy and how documentaries have changed after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The documentary Iris just came out. It's a portrait of 93-year-old fashion maven Iris Apfel.
Mrs. Lohman, the original, said, "You're not pretty, and you'll never be pretty, but it doesn't matter. You have something much better. You have style."
Iris is a film about an icon made by another icon, Albert Maisels. It's also one of his last films. He died on March 5th. He was 88 years old. Albert and his brother David, who died back in 1987, were documentary legends. They made films like Salesman, Gimme Shelter, and Grey Gardens.
The relatives didn't know that they were dealing with a staunch character. And I tell you, if there's anything worse than a staunch woman, S-T-A-U-N-C-H. There's nothing worse, I'm telling you.
The Maisels were known for their fly-on-the-wall style and for subjects that were either in the center of the cultural universe or the farthest point from it. When they started making films in the 60s, documentaries were mostly dry, didactic, and obscure. But these days, documentaries are everywhere and about everything, and they often rival fiction films for pure entertainment value. With the death of Albert Maisels, we thought we'd talk about the state of documentaries now. I'm joined by Matt Holzman, producer here on Press Play, a lover of documentaries and the host of KCRW's screening series First Take. You
Hello.
Are a lover of documentaries.
I truly, if I could see documentaries just all the time, that's what I would do.
Okay. Well, maybe you'll star in one day. What did you think of Iris?
What did you think of Iris?
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Yeah. I was riveted from the beginning to the very end.
Yeah, well,
and part of it was because she is such a compelling character
well, I
to
mean,
look at.
That's one of the great
to.
Things about documentaries is you get to just spend time with people, and when you're spending time with somebody like Iris Apfel, it's just such a delight. It's kind of interesting that that this film is a weird kind of B-side to Grey Gardens, which is arguably the Maisel's most popular film. That of course was a 1975 movie about two very eccentric women, the Beals. And one of the complaints about the Maisels was that they were making fun of their subjects. And in that movie, you could argue that you're watching two somewhat mentally ill people, yeah, you know, for 2 hours on film. And Iris is the exact opposite. This is a very eccentric woman for sure, but so lovely. And you want to just spend more time with her. And it is clearly a very loving portrait of her. But what's even more different than those two films is the kind of environment in which they were made. You know, when Grey Gardens was made, documentaries were just, maybe you would see it on a college campus, maybe mm-hmm. you would see it in a theater, but most likely you just wouldn't see it. And now Iris was acquired by a pretty good-sized company, Magnolia. It's open in like 37 theaters now, and it's probably going to be opened in more. And in August, it'll be released online, and anybody anywhere will be able to see it for basically for eternity. And that is a totally different place for documentaries.
Well, so there are more documentaries being made now than ever before, yes, and there are more places to watch them now than ever before, digitally, for example. So is that what's driving this increase in documentary making?
Well, I think the argument that most people would make is that, yeah, the digital age, both in making movies and in watching movies, has basically brought on the kind of resurgence of documentaries. And I think that that's true. And also the fact that, you know, we document everything now. You have an iPhone, you document everything. So documentary is more familiar to us. And so as a form of entertainment, documentaries are more acceptable. But I think what actually brought that on was kind of just right before the digital age. It's almost like we were getting prepared for the digital age and the age of new documentaries with reality TV. I mean, all of a sudden, documentary style, if not documentary, was a form of entertainment. And so we became more familiar with that. It's actually interesting. In 1994, Steve James made an extraordinary film called Hoop Dreams, mm-hmm. about a couple of young black kids who were trying to make it in the majors, two basketball players. And famously, Fine Line tried to market the film to kids in the inner city. And the feedback they got from the kids as they came out of the screening was, that wasn't a movie. And back then,
and they didn't like it.
They really didn't like it. First of all, they didn't feel the need to see their own lives on a screen. They uh-huh. lived it every day. But also, just formatically, it was like, that's not a movie. And now we see documentaries as movies. Like, we would go to the theater to see a documentary much more because we are more prepared for it. And I think another reason is, you know, you have to give him credit, Michael Moore. Mm. I mean, Roger and Me first in 1989, and then Fahrenheit 9/11 in 2004, still the biggest grossing documentary of all time at over $200 million.
Congressman, trying to get members of Congress to get their kids to enlist in the Army and go over to Iraq.
And his kind of entertaining documentary, I think, opened a lot of people's minds to the idea of watching, going to the theater, watching yeah. documentaries as entertainment. It also kind of happened right at the time where our political culture got more and more antagonistic. And documentaries, I think, kind of fed into that, that these documentaries about your point of view, you know, and now because of digital, you could make a movie about your point of view.
But doesn't it seem like the point of view most often represented in those kinds of documentaries is a left-leaning point of view?
Well, you know, yes, I think that that is true. And I, that may just come out of the tradition of documentaries, which I think at one time, you know, you had to be a trust fund kid or a college professor to make a documentary, right? You had to have money. You had to have means otherwise, because documentaries cost money and they didn't make money. And so perhaps that's out of that tradition, or maybe the tradition of you know, I don't know why that is. I think it definitely is true.
Okay, so all in all, it is a great time for documentaries.
It is an unbelievable time for documentaries. I mean, there are definitely way more of them. There are more theaters that play docs. There are so many cable channels that you can find docs, you can't even count them. There are endless amounts of online options. There are places like the Sundance Now doc channel that Tom Powers from the Toronto Film Festival programs, where you can see the most extraordinary documentaries for like almost nothing. Also, I think digital production, the cost going down, and the fact that if you can't find a distributor, you can put it online, means that there's more opportunities for diversity in the kinds of films that you see. There's more funding than ever. I mean, right, so there's Kickstarter and there's Indiegogo. There are foundations like the Ford Foundation who have just invested huge amounts of money, always have, really. Companies like Impact Partners that are funders. Distribution, you know, production and distribution companies like Participant, even cable channels like HBO. So there's tons of money. They're just generally better films, right? Like, I just was thinking about this. So we've been hearing in the news a lot about the 1985 bombing in Philadelphia of the MOVE headquarters. Mm-hmm. And there's a documentary that came out a couple of years ago called Let the Fire Burn about what happened there.
Can you describe the philosophy of MOVE?
We were being taught about the corruption in this system.
The system, the establishment, you.
Did you consider the MOVE organization to be a terrorist group?
People who threaten to shoot and kill neighbors, police. I think that's a pretty adequate description of the word terrorist.
And it is old school, this documentary, in a lot of ways, in that it's mostly archival footage. And yet the filmmaking, in terms of just the storytelling, is so riveting that had we had that material and made this film 20 years ago, it would have been a little dry. And there might have been a college professor saying, yes, and they did this and they did that. Mm. But in this movie, you are completely compelled. In all of these movies, it's just like, it's better than any fiction film. I mean, they're so compelling.
Well, but then you raise an ethical dilemma, which I think The Jinx also raised. This is the movie that HBO just aired, the series about Robert Durst. And that is it too entertaining? Does it kind of slip and slide around the facts for the entertainment value?
So, yeah, this is a problem that documentaries can get into, but the best of them should never even go there, I think. I want to say one other thing that about why documentaries are so great is that as film, they have gotten so much more interesting. And I think of Sarah Pauley's Stories We Tell, which is just like they're playing with the documentary form in a way that is just like you can't even believe what you're seeing. And talk about entertaining, but also so emotionally moving and thought-provoking, you know, incredible.
This is her exploration into her own family and right. The secrets that her family had about
yes.
who her parents were.
You know, the stories they didn't tell and the stories that they did tell and kind of making sense of both of those.
Can you describe the whole story in your own words?
What? The entire story... I guess I better pee first.
If you haven't seen it, I don't want to give too much away, but she does take the documentary form and kind of turns it on its head. And also, Josh Oppenheimer's maybe one of the most extraordinary films I've seen, maybe in my lifetime, The Act of Killing, about the killing that went on in Indonesia in the 60s and the unrepentant killers who are the winners in that case. And some people argue, and again, you talked about kind of the morality or the ethics of documentary, that he gave these killers too much leeway to flaunt what they did. And viewers, I disagree with that completely. But just in terms of filmmaking, it's so extraordinary what these people are doing with this format and still sticking, I think, fairly strictly within the boundaries of what documentaries are. I mean, these are amazing films. But, so we're talking about the upsides, right?
There's got to be a downside.
Of course, is really a downside. So I was talking about the fact that documentaries have partially been a reaction to this kind of age where we don't talk to each other and we don't agree with each other and people want to stand on the mountaintop and tell what their ideas are and they want to be heard. And the funny thing about that is that's resulted in documentaries that are just so like polemic and dry and self-serious and earnest and hit you over the head with a topic. It's just ridiculous. And I'm not going to name names, but God, you see these movies.
Go ahead, name names.
No. But I will tell you that I see most of the documentaries that I see are like this. They aren't great films to begin with, and they don't really change anything because they are so polemic that what they do is they just make people who agree with them feel good about their point of
view.
And what's interesting about this is that the digital age has solved the biggest problem that real documentary film had, which was you didn't want to keep filming because film costs money and developing costs money. And so you kind of wanted to know what you were going to get into ahead of time. And the idea of just filming and following a story and see where it went, it was hard to do because it costs so much money. And of course, the best documentaries we know are like that. And I think about Marwan Call, one of my favorite documentaries of all time.
Movie.
This is a story of a guy who suffered some brain injury and is kind of working it out in a small model World War II town where he's playing with these dolls and basically working it out.
Everybody has a dream. Everybody wishes they had a double that could do the things that they could never do.
There's always something going on in Marwan Call. I've taken place in many battles. We usually come out on top.
Jeff Malmberg, who made Marwan Call, kind of just kept filming and filming and filming. And the result is the story unfolds in front of the filmmaker along with the audience, which are, to me, the most magical documentaries. Not the ones where you know what the story you're going to tell ahead of time and then you tell it, but the ones where you don't know what you're getting into and you find the story either in the field or in the editing room. And so digital photography has solved this main problem, allowing filmmakers to do that. And yet those kinds of films are becoming more and more rare.
Well, ironically, that's exactly what the Maisels were doing with their movies Gimme Shelter, with Grey Gardens. Right. They just filmed and filmed. And it unfolded, unspooled in front of them
right.
and us.
Right. And the last thing I just want to say about this double edge of just all this money that's out there is that a lot of it is foundation funding, and the foundations are pushing particular agendas. They're requiring deliverables, and they're requiring impact, and they're requiring metrics. And the result is these well-meaning documentaries that aren't great films and that ultimately don't have great effect and don't live longer than the current uproar about topic A or topic B. And I think that that is unfortunate. And the last thing is, you know, the corporations have gotten into docs, and we are lauding HBO and we're lauding Netflix and CNN for making documentaries. And they have some of the most highest profile documentaries, like The Jinx that you mentioned, and like Going Clear, and like Citizen Four, Lauren Poitras' film. But at some point, you know, corporations and this kind of documentary / journalistic storytelling, they're going to come to a head. They are eventually going to come to loggerheads, and where the corporation is going to say, I don't want you to make that film. I want you to cut this scene. It hasn't happened yet, but I'm telling you, it's coming.
Okay, so what's next?
Well, I think the one thing that is probably the most exciting thing are short documentaries that end up on the internet and go viral. Mm-hmm. Like that's, I mean, I don't even know that much about them, and I'm really stuck in the past in these long documentaries, but I think those, you know, the Kony documentary, which we can argue about all day long, I mean, the kind of impact that kind of documentary filmmaking can have is really quite extraordinary. And I think
that's Joseph Kony 2012. That,
exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so what's on your docket for this year? What are some good documentaries we can look forward to?
Laura Gabbert has made a film about Jonathan Gold called City of Gold that will make you fall in love with Los Angeles all over again. Joshua Oppenheimer has followed up his act of killing with The Look of Silence, which is about kind of seeing what happened in Indonesia from the victim side, which is a really compelling film. And Morgan Neville made a film, you know, I was talking about how this kind of polemic political atmosphere and reality television kind of has spawned documentaries. Mm-hmm. Well, this is about a movie called Best of Enemies. It's about Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley and their debates during the 1968 presidential conventions, and in a way how they help spawn reality television. So it all kind of comes full circle.
All right. I'm looking forward to it. Matt Holzman, producer here on Press Play and host of KCRW's screening series, First Take. Thank you.
You are welcome.
Keeping it in the family, Warren Olney, another family member.
Indeed. A family member and a happy one as well. We're going to be talking today about drilling in the Arctic Ocean. You know, President Obama has said that all things need to be considered when it comes to, no pun intended, when it comes to energy sources. And so he's protected part of the ocean, but not all of the ocean. And he will allow Shell Oil to take some oil rigs up there, two of them, actually, because they have to come back and forth because the season changes all mm-hmm. the time, for exploratory reasons. And this has set off a firestorm amongst the environmentalists.
Yeah, Bill McKibben is outraged.
He is, and so are many others. So it's a very interesting issue, and there's going to be a lot of action, of course, in the Arctic because mm-hmm. of global warming anyway. Yeah.
Okay, look forward to that at 1 o'clock. Coming Indeed. Up on this program, another family member, maybe an ex-family member. We're going to talk about Harry Shearer leaving The Simpsons after 26 seasons.
He was one of the founding cast members.
Yeah, way back on the Tracy Ullman show. Anyway, we're going to talk about that next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Since the beginning of The Simpsons, actor and comedian Harry Shearer has voiced more than 100 characters on the show, like the evil tycoon Mr. Burns.
A slick Hollywood picture to gloss over my evil rise to power like Bugsy or Working Girl. Get me Steven Spielberg.
He's unavailable.
Then get me his non-union Mexican equivalent.
And Homer's neighbor and foil, Ned Flanders.
And Harry Potter and all his wizard friends went straight to hell for practicing witchcraft.
Yay!
And Smithers, and Principal Skinner, and Dr. Hibbert, and Reverend Lovejoy, and dozens of other minor characters. Harry Shearer, though, will not be returning as any of those voices. After 26 seasons, he's quitting. Alan Sepinwall is a television reviewer and writer for the entertainment website HitFix. Hi, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so what's the official reason for his leaving?
He doesn't want to be there anymore. You know, it's he has been somewhat vocally unhappy, it sounds like, at The Simpsons for a while. There have been a number of really contentious cast renegotiations over salary. He has always been sort of the vocal leader in other public comments. You get the sense it's just he's been over the show for a while, and they say that they offered him the exact same deal that they offered everybody else. And on top of that, they said you can literally phone it in, just call in for the table reads, call in your recordings. You don't have to physically show up anywhere. And he still didn't want to do it. So unless they can sort of play on sympathies, at this point, it sounds like he just wants to go.
Okay. Well, he's been with the show forever, right? Since the beginning, when it was just an animated short on the Tracy Ullman show back in the late 80s?
No, he and Hank Azaria were not part of the Tracy Ullman cast.
Oh,
those
weren't?
Shorts were pretty much just the family. The two of them joined when it became The Simpsons.
Okay, but still, he's been there for, what, 26 seasons?
Yes, a quarter century.
Yeah,
that's a long time for anyone to have any job.
Yeah. So how much creative input did he have on those characters? Was he creating them, or was he just voicing lines?
He was voicing them. I mean, The Simpsons have had one of the great writing staffs of all times. Conan O'Brien used to work there. Greg Daniels, who created The Office, worked there. A lot of amazing writers were on The Simpsons. But certainly the voice cast, Shearer, Azaria, Dan Castellaneta, Julie Kavner, Nancy Cartwright, everyone has they played as much of a role in making those characters indelible as the writers and as the animators. It was a great, perfect collaboration.
And where is he compared to the other voice actors in terms of the amount of characters that he did and the effect on the show?
Oh, God. I mean, Mr. Burns was essentially the star of the show for a bunch of years there.
Yeah.
You know, up to the point where they did the Who Shot Mr. Burns episode. So certainly Bart was the original breakout character. Then Homer became the main character and has continued to be so. But, I mean, Flanders, Burns, Skinner, they have done so much with so many of those characters. And he does such a wide swath of things. It sounds like they're not even going to try replacing him with one single voice actor, but instead try to bring in a bunch of different people, which speaks to how versatile Shearer's been.
Yeah. Well, do you know how it works, the mechanics of it, how they actually record those voices? Do they do a bunch of episodes all at once and do all the voices at once, or do they separate it out?
I mean, I don't know exactly how many episodes are done at once, but I believe that the actors go in sort of one at a time. It's not like he is in a sound booth with Dan Castellaneta and they're playing a Homer Mr. Burns scene. It's just he's doing his lines and someone else does their lines.
Right. So they can't get rid of characters like, as you say, Mr. Burns or Ned Flanders. Those are so integral to the show. So how hard will it be to find someone to replace Harry Shearer for those characters?
I mean, it's going to be tricky, but it can be done. So someone else has been playing Kermit the Frog. Several people have played Kermit the Frog since Jim Henson died. There are new voices doing the Looney Tunes characters in those things now. It's a thing that happens. It's amazing that The Simpsons is still on the air and has kept the original core six cast members together for all this time, but they're going to try it.
Right. And so speak to that, if you will. Why is it still popular and how has it been able to endure a quarter century?
It's still popular because, I mean, I think partly because there's so much nostalgia for that first decade or so when the show was clearly at its best. But it's still, I think, often very good. It's not consistently great in the way that it was back in the 90s. But, you know, how could you expect any show to be at this point? But it's still good enough, and it's become such a fabric of our lives that it's just this reassuring thing to have on Sundays at 8 and to know that every now and then, even at this advanced age, they can really lean back and throw a vintage fastball.
Do you know who's watching it these days?
I don't know the exact audience demographic breakdown, no.
Are you watching it?
Yes.
Okay. So
no, I mean, I hear people all the time, and, you know, when I wrote the story about this on HitFix today, there was a lot of comments of, please just end the show, please just end the show, and other people saying, yeah, but I'm still enjoying it. You can just stop watching, and it doesn't affect you at all. So there's these people who feel offended that it's continued well past the point where they stop watching. And then there are people, either the people have stuck with it, or in some cases there are people who discovered it, it sounds like, fairly late in the run and wouldn't even appreciate a reference to the episode where he asks for Spielberg's non-union Mexican equivalent.
Alan Sepinwall, TV reviewer and writer for the entertainment website HitFix. Thanks, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Julie Myers.
I am here with the feedback, and
welcome.
You can believe that people had thoughts on The Simpsons today. So we asked our audience which characters they just couldn't live without on the show, and there were a lot of Mr. Burns. Yeah, lots of fans out there. There were some Milhouse fans. Plenty of people have weighed in on our Facebook page. We want to hear from you, too. My spirit animal Simpsons character is Comic Book Guy.
Well, also Harry Shearer, right?
No comment, Madeline. I have no idea. But he is my spirit animal, and I would be devastated, even though I don't even watch the show anymore. So it's this weird kind of...
nostalgia thing.
It's a nostalgia thing. So.
Yeah. All right. Well,
that's it.
Okay. Thanks, Julie Myers. We would like to hear from you. What is your spirit animal? You can tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney and To The Point up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.